Good afternoon. I believe it is February 12th. You know what? We're only 2 days away from February 14th, and I think everybody knows that that is a special day for Oregon.
Yep, Oregon's birthday.
And I am opening up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and I understand that I am opening up a work session on the parole board, and it's an update on the statistics on the 99 reviews. And can we take it away, Ellis?
Co-chair, members of the committee, last Wednesday we had the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision in to give us an update on the static 99R assessments. We were only scheduled for an informational hearing, so we couldn't take official action to acknowledge receipt of the report. And so that's what we need to do, and then I'm done.
Can I have a...
Co-Chair Winters, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report from on the static 99.
Co-Chair Stark recommends that we've acknowledged receipt of report on the update of the static of 99 reviews. Any objections? Any dissension? And next up, Department of Public Safety Standard and Training and an Assist to Firefighters grant. I think, Eric, you're up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. For the record, Eric Skablich from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. What we have in front of you today is a request to retroactively apply for a FEMA Assistance to Firefighters grant. As many of you know, we've been very successful in this program for 3 years in replacing much needed equipment that we wouldn't have the funds to do otherwise. And what we'd like to do this year is submit a grant request to replace an aging tender that we have at the training center. It's a tender that we purchased from the city of Salem when they got new equipment. It served us well, but it's costing us more to keep it in service. So hopefully this grant will alleviate that issue for us. So I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Gee, they're nice today, Eric.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
No questions?
Cool. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Gee.
They like no questions.
Bam. No questions either. What are we going to do with this grant?
Senator Winters, subcommittee members, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that you approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application for $343,104 to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Assistance to Firefighters Grant Program for firefighting equipment.
We need any other approval?
Co-Chair Winters, I move the incredibly well-worded LFO recommendation.
Co-Chair Stark moves the recommendation of LFO. Are there any objections?
Nope.
So approved. We're rocking this morning. Stark.
So good.
And I believe we've got next the Oregon military. I'm going to close the hearing, the work session, and open an information hearing. You're back up. Department of Public Safety Standard and Training, Eric.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Eric Skablich, Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. What we wanted to do is to bring you up to speed on where we are with enrollment and training numbers. For some of you know, we spent quite a bit of time during our budget presentation for agency request budget. And for Representative Helfer, just will be reliving what you went through at Portland when you were the recruiting sergeant. So we're going to basically walk through what we did and walk through where we are right now and where we're heading. I'm joined today by Denver Peterson, who is the director of our Business and Information Services division at DPSST. So we'll flip to the next slide. So just an overview. Remember, the Academy provides training for law enforcement professionals, men and women from city, county, state, tribal, university agencies across the state. A newly hired police officer comes to us for 16 weeks. A city, county corrections officer comes to us for 6 weeks. Parole and probation officer comes to us for 5 weeks and an additional week if they're armed. A 911 operator comes to us for 2 weeks. That program is actually going to be expanded by a week, probably in July of this year. The emergency medical dispatch program is 1 week. OLCC regulatory specialist is 4 weeks, and then for officers that come in after 2.5 to 5 years, come back into Oregon service, or for officers from out of state coming to Oregon, we offer what we call a career officer development program, which is primarily focused on Oregon laws, because those men and women already know how to drive a police car, they know how to use a weapon, they know how to de-escalate a hostile situation. This is bringing them up to speed on Oregon criminal code, Oregon vehicle code, and other related matters, and those are 2 week training opportunities at the Academy. So this is an updated snapshot of what our workload was last year, and you see we go back to 2013 to kind of give you a longer look at it. But last year was a very busy year for DPSST. If you look at 2017, we trained 442 newly hired police officers. We trained 211 city county corrections officers, 78 parole and probation officers, 189 911 operators, 75 emergency medical dispatchers, 65 came to police career officer development, and only 5 for corrections career officer development. And this really is the beginning. As you remember, I use the term that's in the magazines a lot, is the silver tsunami, which is the amount of people that are getting ready to retire that are retiring, and we're seeing that. So that was 2017, and you see to date, so this is as of last Thursday when I sent Julie the slides, you'll see the enrollment numbers already enrolled in classes at the Academy right now. So what we had to do last year in partnership with the legislature was add classes, which required us to receive more resources, and you've been very kind in helping us meet that need. The purple class was the June class that ended up actually coming in to the 15-17 biennium. You'll see all of the black classes where the class is funded as part of our agency budget, and then we came back and asked for your assistance for 4 additional classes to finish up that 17, and then you'll see those blue were an additional request we had to get additional funds to finish up basic police training, and that was last biennium. So that allowed us to kind of address the issue that you heard very loud and clear from chiefs and sheriffs, was many of them were waiting for more than 4 or 5 months to get a newly hired officer into the Academy, and I think you'll be pretty pleased when I show you what we're doing and where we're at today. Similar numbers in corrections. You'll see the purple was a class out of last biennium that carried in to 15-17. Then the black were the funded classes. And then we came back and asked for legislative assistance twice, one for the red classes, and then again for the blue classes. And that allowed us to meet the volume of people that were coming forward. So if you look at where we are today for enrollment, we haven't taken our foot off the gas pedal, honestly, since we started this biennium. The purple classes began in 15-17. They carry over into 17-19, so the bulk of that expense is in the current biennium. The black classes are what you funded for us. We have a request in right now for the red classes. You will see our numbers are not slowing down. We have been starting classes with 40 every month. I can tell you the basic police 379, which starts March 19th, now has 36 people, so we anticipate that'll be full within a number of weeks. And then you see we're loading people into April, and we're already loading people into later on, because agencies know when they have men and women retiring, so they're able to forecast that, so we're putting them into classes as they come up. Our plan, as you know from our discussions, is to start a basic police class every month if needed, and if budget allows, to meet the need. And we're getting these new hires in within a 90-day window, which is a very good place to be, and we haven't been there for a while. One of the things that we've been very honest with our stakeholders, and that's the chiefs and sheriffs, is that we won't run a class if there are less than 20 students in the class. It doesn't make fiscal sense for us. So if, for example, April only had 20 or let's say 19, we won't run that class for 19. We'll push those people back into May. We haven't had that problem since we started this biennium. We're running at full speed. And what we've said is we've got the bandwidth. We just need assistance with staffing to make that happen. So there request that we have in front of the Ways and Means Committee is to fill the red classes. And then if we stay on this keel, The purple, I'm sorry, the light blue classes we would come and ask for when the session comes together in 19. But again, we're looking at the potential of more than 1,000 certified police officers eligible to retire over the next 3 years. If you think about, is that a big number? Is that a small number? What we can tell you is that's approximately 20% of the law enforcement officers in the state of Oregon that will be retiring in the next 3 years. So it's a pretty significant hit. Corrections is the same. This is again for city county corrections. You'll see those numbers are full. We currently have a space in both April and June, but that's one person. We're concerned that we might need to move a class up a little further, and we'll make that decision in a few weeks based on what we get from our stakeholders. But we do have a request in right now for two additional classes, which will get us to the end of the biennium for corrections. Again, a little bit smaller number, and these agencies in a lot of cases, especially outside the I-5 corridor agencies, a lot of the smaller counties just can't send two new hired corrections officers at one time. They need the staffing. So Sherman County may send one. I'm sorry, that's a bad example because they use NorCorps. Klamath County may send one and then hold one back and then send them the next class. They just can't send two at once, where Multnomah County, Washington County has a lot more employees, so they could send more people to us. So this is the chart that we showed you last year. We've updated it with 2017 numbers. You'll see a total for the basic training students at the academy, 1,065 is what we trained, and we anticipate that number will continue to go up into 2018 and probably 2019 if this trend continues. Again, we don't know how many people will retire. We know how many people are eligible to retire, but since we've had this discussion with you during the full session, people haven't slowed down. People are retiring. People are leaving law enforcement work, and what we want to make sure is that we have classes available for those new hires when they get hired coming on board. This is just another snapshot of what we did last year. Again, we started with 13 and 6 for corrections. We added 4 for police, added 2 for corrections, added 3, and then ended up with 20 for police and 9 for corrections. And you'll see this year we started with 15 for police. We're asking for 5 now. We started with 8 for corrections. We're adding 1 now. And we'll have to basically see where we end up at the back end of 19. I'd like to say we're wrong and this will be over soon, but I don't think that's going to be a realistic expectation during at least this biennium. We think that the retirements are going to continue, and we're going to keep having to train new students. So one of the things that we've heard a lot and a lot of news, and actually COIN TV is covering this over a series of weeks, but how do we find men and women that want to work in law enforcement? Law enforcement is struggling, just like every employer in Oregon is struggling to find qualified men and women to do the different work that's necessary. So Washington County, you'll see, is looking at 50 deputies retire. This is a story that they have. Everybody's changing their hiring practices and their recruiting strategies. Portland Police Bureau has a request pending for 85 new officers within the Portland Police Bureau. As Representative Helfrich knows, that number has been kind of a moving target over the last 2 years because Portland has already seen a large number of people retire that were hired during the 80s.
I believe Senator Steiner has a question.
No, you're fine.
Director, you know, I'm a huge fan of education. On the other hand, and actually I'd appreciate Representative Helfrich's perspective on this as well, but Representative Barker, for that matter, I'm a huge fan of education, but I have to wonder whether we've done ourselves a favor by requiring a college degree for a lot of our law enforcement personnel, because I think that there are some very experienced people out there who may have chosen a different path and now might be willing to look at law enforcement as a good career and have life experience that would add to their maturity and their value. I don't mean to presume to tell you all how to do your business, but I do wonder, I've been thinking a lot about the issue of education, given our shortage of skilled workers of various types in the state. I'm just interested in thoughts.
Well, the last I checked with Portland, the GED will get you in the door.
Yeah. Well, that was not high school.
Yeah, we at one time briefly had college requirement.
Yeah, I didn't realize that had gone away. That's good because that's exactly the concern.
And in 1970, the police union in Portland wanted to professionalize, and they demanded two years of college, but you could get it over a 5-year period. So, and then of course there was federal money paying at the time, LEA money, and the city paid some money, so people could get the basic education, so they'd have a little broader perspective world. They'd be able to learn how to write a report, which, having read a million reports, some of them don't know how to do that. But anyway, so that
still,
But still, they're trying to get, yeah, we're trying to get people from all over.
So I'm sorry, I should have called on you.
Oh, I tell you.
She's just the chief.
That's right. That's all.
But I'm sorry, Representative Paluso, I apologize.
No problem. I've been called worse.
I forgot how many law enforcement personnel we have in this community.
In the building.
In the building. But just to pile on a little bit, in addition, you know, we did it. The two experts can remind me. We also are moving to where we want excellence in policing.
Absolutely.
And so I can remember Chief Teague and getting me to get that the legislation passed and actually funding it, because as society actually comes with a lot more issues and what have you, that I think we recognize for us here in Oregon, we want to make certain that not only can you have the entry in, but that we're actually developing a career and a force that actually addresses all the needs. And I think I speak for those of us who actually made certain that we funded that and actually passed that legislation, because I don't want the general public to think that, you know, it's getting in and it stops there, because that really is not what's happening to us here in Oregon.
Excellent point.
Yes.
Co-chair, sorry.
Our new rep.
Yes. To answer Senator Hayward's question, the police bureau, there are several different pathways. They still do have a degree requirement. However, there's numerous pathways to get into that. That's changed over since Representative Barker was there. But I do know the other law enforcement agencies that I was working with, and we were talking about recruiting strategies, whether you're the reserve program or a cadet program, they were using those hours to offer ability, and then some college to get into there, and then some obviously with a military background, just in not necessarily military police or anything, but just any type of military background helped. But there are those opportunities there that they looked at that were missing. They were missing people with a diamond in the rough that had the ability to get in the door, get a pathway in, and have that opportunity to do that, whether it was through a sworn rank or even a non-sworn position, professional position, where they were taking reports, being interactive with the community, and then they had a pathway into the sworn position and ranks. So there's a very...
My information was out of date, and so I appreciate all the updates. Thank you.
And co-chairs and Senator Steinert Hayward, just to add on, because I think it's a very good question. So we look at what you heard is what's the hiring standard. And the state standard is high school diploma or GED is the minimum for all of our positions. But we have a partnership with the community colleges where all of our basic programs at DPSST are college accredited. Yeah. So the men and women coming through basic training can get college credit. What we realize through our work with our constituents and our board is that we seek ongoing professional development. So if you're going to seek an intermediate or advanced certification, you have to have college credits as part of that, or a high school diploma. You know, we just see that as a natural bridge for ongoing professional development to move up in agencies and also for personal growth. So that's one of the things that we are very much committed to. The other thing that wasn't brought up that's important to share is that with our basic programs right now, 30 to 40% of the men and women getting hired are military veterans. So these are people that have had a world of experience, right, in many cases around the world, serving our country, but they are coming in, retiring or leaving military service, and they're being hired by law enforcement agencies. So we're very active there. And then also, I think if you came out to the academy, what you would see is a wide variety of different people seeking positions in law enforcement. It's people that have had already one career that want to do something different. They want structure. They want to serve their community. We also have, you know, people that are just out of high school that are looking at this. Obviously, you know, there's an age requirement, but we run from, and what I like to tell people, from 21 to 60. We run into everything at DPSST, and that's what we're here for.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to see that the kind of range that you have. I have been concerned, quite frankly, about the military aspect of this. And I have other folks within my community who are frankly concerned about the overemphasis on military as a concern with some of the folks who have in the past come in with the idea that they are not necessarily there in terms of community policing, but are there to control. And so that's one of the, that's a clear concern. And I think we, we need to be rethinking that. I was looking over your and you'll probably get to this, the curriculum, et cetera, but looking over that, and it's a concern. And so as we get as many people as possible who are really involved in terms of community policing, I'd appreciate that a lot more. I understand getting folks who are coming out of the military, it's good. We need to have something for folks to be able to do that, but the approach has got to change, because when you're in the military, you're doing one thing. When you're in the community, in the neighborhood, it's a different thing altogether. So I just appreciate that approach.
Yes, and co-chairs and Senator Frederick, and it's a good segue to the document. I didn't put a PowerPoint slide in here for this, but I wanted to share with you the phase one curriculum changes that we're looking at for the 16 weeks, and it really embraces that issue. If you came to the academy, you would see the men and women wearing an academy uniform. Then they graduate into their agency uniform. You know, we do have discussions about external body armor versus under-the-shirt body armor. Those are not decisions we make, but I know some communities just don't want that look because they feel it's too militaristic. Those are really local agency issues, but we're aware of them. But what we really are embraced to is creating problem solvers at the academy, not robots that just respond from call to call, but that engage with their citizens, that get out of the patrol car, that meet with people, that have coffee with people, and find out about community livability issues. So I think if you take the time, and I appreciate that you've looked at it, but what we did with the basic police course, over the last 10 years, and Senator Wooners will remember this, when we cut the ribbon on the new academy, and a lot of you were there, the new academy has been here in Salem for just over 11 years now. We have a great training platform, and we've run a very good basic course, and we've updated over years, but what we're doing is stripping it down to the frame. We have to rebuild that program to make sure it's meeting the needs of our communities today into the future. So we have citizen members involved in the curriculum review group, as well as different stakeholders from across the state, from different backgrounds, from different communities. So you're seeing things in that new curriculum that was never discussed before. We also are pretty excited about where the curriculum is going, because what you're seeing is phase one. We've sliced it up into four segments because it's just too big to update at once. So we're going to basically work on it over the next year and a half and hopefully line up the front and the back when we're done with it, so all four segments are there. But it's very creative, and I'll tie to something Senator Winter said, which is this project is being led by the Center for Policing Excellence, which is the outcome of 3194. This is something that we are being watched carefully by other states. We also have brought in the assistance of Dr. Stephen James from Washington State University. And our goal is at the end of this is to hopefully be the first basic law enforcement training program that is completely evidence-based. We don't know if we'll be able to get to 100%, but at least for the bulk of it, what we're looking at is evidence-based practices for how we train newly hired police officers. So I agree completely with what you say, and I think we're going to be there at the end of this.
Follow up. I'm not sure whether you're planning on going into a specific discussion of the curriculum or not. Are you planning on doing that?
I had not, but let me just add, so much of what's happening at the academy, we also must understand, and I can speak for my community, and each one of us can speak for ours, so much of the implementation when they go back home is based on what's happening in their respective communities. And so, the chief here will, actually set the tone and the tenor for what's happening with her and whether we're talking about community policing and some of those. From the academy, I think from a state perspective, when we did the 3194 and the policing excellence, it was our opportunity then to add that additional layer, which is what we did. And I have to tell you, the chief did beat me over the head for a lot of days, saying that I needed to fund this and I needed to do this in order to bring us, into the 21st century, which is what we've done. I'm excited about it. I'm excited about, one, we did take that next leap. Two, I think, for us in Oregon, for years, and I know when Senator Gordley was here, the whole issue of not only the community policing, but how we actually address the issue of the mentally ill, yes. How we address these issues that are embodied inside of our communities. And so, you know, those pushes and those tensions have been there, and we've actually said to the Academy, we want you to help us to be able to help the community in order to do their job. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, the framework, if you will, of what the push is. But I, as you know, all politics and all work is local, and so you have to get back to your local communities. But as far as our investment and what we're trying to do at the State Academy, I think you're going to see more, actually.
Well, I appreciate that, and I would like to have a longer conversation with you.
Absolutely.
And reading over the Phase 1 efforts, there were a couple of things that were concerning me, and I just want to bring them up briefly. The hard versus soft skill sets that you mm-hmm. work with. You know, that's the balance there, the amount of time that's used, devoted to those things versus what's going on in terms of soft skills. The resilience component, a number of you have heard me talk about the concern about psychological visits, psychological status for folks. The resilience is an important factor, and I'm curious, I read the section that you have, I'd like to know more, a little bit more about that. And basically, whether we have seen how well we are using what's called the six pillars of 21st century mm-hmm. policing, how well that is actually being, how much we're doing with that within the curriculum. So at some point, if we get a chance, I'd like to talk with you about that.
Sure. And co-chairs and Senator Frederick, I don't think we're going to have that time today, but I'm glad to schedule a time and come here. One thing I will add, though, or share, which ties into the pillars discussion, and Senator Winters knows this from her work with Chief Teague and Sheriff Myers, DPSST was invited to testify to the President's Commission on 21st Century Policing, specifically on the Center for Policing Excellence. We are very unique in Oregon because we do have a singular state academy for every law enforcement officer in the state of Oregon, so that allows us to do some innovative things like you're seeing here, and also bringing in new theories, new concepts that other academies haven't even looked at. So we're pretty excited about where we're heading, but we'd be glad to come
in.
Eric,
can you share how many academies they have in California?
California has more than 24 academies.
Oh, my God. How can they possibly?
That's the point.
Yeah, no, we're very fortunate here to have that standard.
I understand. Thank you.
Yes.
I'd love to talk with you about it.
Yes.
Thank you.
So continuing, and I'm almost finished, so I apologize. So this, again, is what is DPSST doing to help our partners? We have our campaign, which is OregonPoliceJobs.com. I know Co-Chair Stark, during our last presentation, you logged into that and looked at how many positions there are open. This continues to be a great resource that we do in partnership with the state police and the chiefs and sheriffs. Since we launched this over 6 months ago, 65,000 people have looked at this site to look at what jobs are available there. And it's a singular clearinghouse to let people know what's available for jobs in Oregon. This is what it looks like. Snapshot, it'll take you to the agency. It'll tell you what the position is. This is an older slide. It also tells you what the status is, who to contact. This is a big issue as we recruit people. People want to talk to somebody or contact somebody at the agency. So this links them into that person's email so they can communicate with them to find out more about the job. And then also a phone number and what the salary is, because as we know, and Representative Helfrich knows from his time as a recruiter, people want to know what the pay is in a lot of these places. In other places, they just want to work for the local police department or sheriff's office. But in the metro area, I-5 corridor, people are very actively competing to work at multiple agencies. They might have applied at Beaverton, Hillsborough, Gresham, Portland, and they're waiting for the phone to ring so somebody can tell them, we want to hire you. So we keep working that actively. We have a career fair scheduled again. We'll do that in April at DPSST. Last year, we had over 2,000 people come for that, very well received, with more than 48 partner agencies there. And then we are also doing something unique. Some of you know, in partnership with the state police, we've hosted the American Legion Career Camp at DPSST. This year, the FBI has approached us, and they offer what they call a youth academy to let men and women know about opportunities, both as agents and support positions. And they asked if they could do that at DPSST, and we told them that we would be glad to host that.
Senator Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got to say, if you get a chance, you want to go out to this. If you get to this at all, they hold it as well out near the airport at the FBI site. And I was lucky enough to be a keynote speaker for them and got a tour of what of the program and got a chance to talk with the students. They are excited. It's really quite an amazing. You couldn't help but be excited, but with the way that the work that they do, and they run them through pretty quickly, but it's an exciting thing to see. So if you get a chance going out there to them, and if they're going to come down and do this thing at DPSST, they're going to truly enjoy themselves.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. And as Representative Barker knows, we've had discussions is that if we're waiting for kids to get out of high school, we're waiting too long.
Yep.
Men and women are making up their career decisions way earlier than that.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Helfrich.
Go, Chair.
I have to learn to look that way.
Director, if you wouldn't mind going back one slide to the Public Safety Career Fair. I think there was an opportunity there on a Saturday where you had a women's only event. Now, I think that was a very important aspect that we talked about when I was there.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind explaining that to the...
Sure. One of the things that we did, because we especially want to diversify the workforce, not just across government, but especially in public safety. What Representative Helfrich is referring to is that on Saturday, we had a women in public safety specifically focus. We had over 600 women come in for that. All of the booths were staffed by females in law enforcement. And then we had a number of panels of females talking about what was like to get your foot in the door, what was it like to be a female police officer, a female corrections officer, and then also what's the process. So our physical fitness folks spent time explaining the physical ability test. Not that there's any secret to it, but you know, a lot of people come and say, I can't do that. And our fitness folks said, you can do this. Anybody could do it if you put your mind to it. So thank you for reminding me about that. But it was a great opportunity. And again, we're looking to do similar things this year to make sure that it's inclusive for everyone that's interested in careers, and especially women and other minorities that we want to recruit for these positions. Thank you. So that's the end of our presentation. So we've had a number of questions throughout, and I believe I've gone over my time a little bit, so I apologize, but I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there any additional questions, comments? I just need to add, because we talked about all the law enforcement community, and I know that Representative Barker knows, at one time I worked for Portland City yeah. Police Detective. So just need to add that context to this panel.
And the only thing, too, I would just say briefly, the people coming out of the military, one of the things is you have a group of people who have been trained and who are drug-free, which is important in trying to get through the application process. And most of them that are coming out of the military, they're going back to civilian life or going back to civilian life. And so, but your concerns are, I mean, I'm not trying to downplay those concerns. That's important as well, to be sure that they're, you know, they're going into community policing, not military B or something.
Right.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, any additional questions with that? Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
And I believe that information will be Oregon Military Department Office of Emergency Management Allocation Administer. I'm saying it slowly, too. All right, Dwayne. And it's the cost to grants.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, Winters, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. And with me today is
Co-chair Winters, Co-chair Stark, members of the committee. I'm Sean McCormick. I'm the Finance Director for the Oregon Military Department.
Co-chair Winters, Co-chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management.
In preparing this presentation, committee, we talked about whoever was sickest had to go to the smallest table, and so unfortunately Andrew won. He's under the weather, so he gets to go out there to the far right. But we have a tag team approach here today, and in our presentation for this Homeland Security audit that was conducted by Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General. Just to put it in context, this is where we want to go. These are outcomes of our presentation today in terms of state budget implications, process improvements, et cetera. OEM number manages a number of grants. Basically, they're a grants RS type of organization. Depending upon the appropriation, federal appropriation and authorization, some grants come and go. But consistently, they have three grants and three grant buckets. One of them is an EMPG people grant. Another one is the disaster component grants, the federal disasters and mitigation. Then the third bucket is the Homeland Security Grant. And it's the Homeland Security Grant program that we wanted to talk to you about today. OEM's predominant relationship, federal relationship, goes without saying, is FEMA. But then FEMA is underneath Department of Homeland Security, which is why they wound up with this audit function. So this is really where we've been. You know, this goes back. I've heard this committee discuss the 9/11 Commission Act of 2007 before. You reminder the act, or there's a commission report in 2002-03-04. Then there is a law that was created in 07. And during this law, it created Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General's position to go out and actually audit states and cities in the Homeland Security Grant Program. There are 58 audits somewhere, you know, in the 2008 to 2014 time frame. I think we're 44th in that batting lineup, and it occurred back in 2012. This is an old audit that's finally coming to fruition within the Office of Emergency Management. As a result of that audit, there were 9 findings. 6 of them are closed. 3 of them are still out there. And so what I'd like to do at this point in time is turn it over to Mr. McCormick, our Director of Financial Administration, here to cover that and other items.
Thank you, sir. This slide showcases what we've done as an organization since the DHS-OIG audit occurred. The first 3 sub-bullets relate to some of the findings that have been closed. We implemented a timesheeting process in January of 2014, which requires our staff to track their time against the specific projects and grants that they're working on. We believe this will allow for a much more defensible audit trail should our personal service costs ever be audited again. We created and rolled out a more defined monitoring schedule to ensure that all the subrecipients of federal funds will receive both a programmatic and a fiscal monitoring visit throughout the life cycle of the grant that they receive. Those monitoring visits are scheduled to include inventory process reviews, fiscal system reviews, plan update reviews, and then interviews with key staff and management personnel. We also modified our grant award timeline to ensure that all the federal funds that we receive are sub-awarded out within 45 days of the state receiving the overarching award. In addition to those new processes and procedures, we also engaged an independent audit to help kind of validate the findings that DHS, OIG came up with regarding cost eligibility and the notion of direct versus indirect cost allocations. The funding for that audit was approved in advance by FEMA to be 100% federally funded, which was great. They also approved the scope of the audit before we undertook it. The initial audit was performed by Marina and Company, and it was your standard financial audit. They asked for documentation. We provided it. They then took a sample of that documentation and reviewed it. They issued their audit in August of 2014, and they concluded the costs that we incurred were, in fact, eligible and that our allocation methodology was, in fact, accurate. Unfortunately, FEMA did not accept this audit as sufficient, and it was primarily due to kind of the limited sample size that the auditing firm used in their audit, and they directed OEM to conduct a new audit. The second audit was also approved for scope and funding to be 100% financed with federal resources, so the state wasn't on the hook for that, which was fantastic. In 2016, we issued an RFP for a new independent auditor, and we selected Moss Adams. They're a highly regarded firm on the West Coast. They do a tremendous amount of business with the state. They've worked with the military department in the past, so we felt very confident in bringing them on board. We asked them to perform a 100% review of all transactions and documentation associated with the grant years in question, which were the FY 10, 11, and 12 awards. We didn't want any ambiguity. We didn't want anybody to come back and say that somebody didn't get a chance to review documentation. The outcome of that audit, which was issued in December of 2016, agreed in large part with what the DHS-OIG audit found, and that our costs, while they were eligible, weren't necessarily supported with good backup documentation. So our timesheeting process that we had prior to January 2014 didn't necessarily meet their requirements. The new process does meet those requirements. It also identified that our allocation methodology for costs such as rent, IT, public affairs, general office supplies, and a number of staff should have been.
Wasn't that just called sloppy transferring between agencies?
Coach Starks, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I said, wasn't that lack of documentation? Wasn't there also some transference between agencies and just some stuff that didn't get in?
Coach Winters, there is some of that, yes. So they also identified that our methodology for rent, office supplies, and staff should have been an indirect as opposed to a direct. The Code of Federal Regulation, not to get into too much budgetese, but they define an indirect cost. Our cost is defined to be indirect if it's deemed to be administrative in nature or can't easily be tied to a single cost object. So Mr. Phelps, as the director of OEM, oversees the entire organization. So he's more administrative in nature than looking specifically at just 1 year of the Homeland Security Grant Program. The audit also confirmed that an indirect cost rate needs to be on file with our cognizant federal agency, which in this case is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and it's something that we did not have when DHS OIG came and did their audit, nor when Moss Adams did theirs. In response to that audit, FEMA submitted two letters to OEM in September of 2017 seeking reimbursements for the question costs. And those question costs came in at about $3 million. And they mandated that OEM also stop charging indirect costs to any federal grant until we had an indirect cost rate approved and on file with FEMA. So to comply with that, effective 1 October of 2017, we did stop charging any costs that we felt met the definition of indirect to all the federal grants that are managed by OEM. Those costs are now being covered 100% with non-federal funds, primarily being general fund. On November 3rd of 2017, we did submit an appeal to FEMA with regard to the amount of the question cost that they identified in their audit. We believe that that figure could be substantially lower than $3 million, and that's based on an additional labor analysis that Moss Adams conducted, and we feel that FEMA may have slightly overlooked that component piece of the audit when they submitted their
report. Can you tell me how much is that?
Co-Chair Winters, we believe the actual figure is closer to $123,000 as opposed to $103,000
against the $3 million.
Co-Chair Winters, that's correct.
Just trying to get my facts straight.
Absolutely. At this time, we are still waiting on an official response from FEMA to our appeal. We know they received it. They acknowledged receipt of our appeal, but they have not gotten back to us. Regardless of the amount owed, FEMA has confirmed to us that we're going to be able to use a tool known as equitable offset to reimburse those costs. And what equitable offset is we will look at the OEM, my shop, we'll look at the entirety of state government and find costs that would have been eligible under the Homeland Security grant, but were actually paid for with state resources. Perhaps the Fusion Center of the DOJ being an example of that. We'll be able to capture those costs, showcase that to FEMA, and they'll use that as the offset to what they say we owe. We've also created and submitted our indirect cost rate proposal for consideration. It's been submitted to FEMA, they've reviewed it, and now it sits with the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, which is the federal agency that is supposed to review and approve all indirect cost rates for the state of Oregon, because we received the preponderance of our federal funds in this state from the Department of Health and Human Services. An indirect cost rate is something that it's a federal requirement that all federal grants really need to have. It assures that the grant recipient, the state in this case, we will have our administrative costs reimbursed by the federal government, and it also assures the federal government that our administrative costs aren't exorbitant, that they're reasonable, and that they're properly allocated across the grants that we manage. Based on the communication that we had with some of our partner states, primarily Washington, as we were building our indirect cost rate, we anticipate it may take between 18 and 24 months before our indirect cost rate proposal is actually finalized. It's a time-intensive process. There's lots of questions, lots of back and forth between the feds and us. So this slide shows where we're going. We're continuing to follow up with FEMA on our appeal. We are waiting to hear from them on a determination to direct us to do an audit of our FY8 and 9 Homeland Security grants. That was a finding outlined in the DHS OIG audit. As discussed earlier, we've transitioned using 100% non-federal funds for our indirect costs for the foreseeable future. We anticipate that's going to mean an increase in general fund expenses for the remainder of this biennium.
So what happens if you don't get that increase?
Co-Chair Winters, if we don't get that increase, it's going to be very, very difficult for the Office of Emergency Management to remain in business.
The majority.
Coach Edwards, yes.
I just like to have it all out of the good and the bad, and also the ugly.
Coach Winters, we don't have 1.6
million. You don't have one?
We don't have $1.6 million. We are using the general fund that exists within OEM to pay for that. When FEMA came in September and sent us two letters on 6 September and said, you're done. we took that. It's one of those golden rules, and he who owns the gold rules. And so we had to change our structure immediately, and so it was a business decision on our part. I fully recognize that, but effective 1 October, we started paying general fund with those positions that we knew FEMA took exception to.
How many positions were those?
Co-chair Winters, we are talking about 7 to 8 staff, primarily the OEM director, the OEM deputy director, administrative support personnel, some fiscal staff, public affairs, and IT staff that have that administrative overall supporting function for the entire organization.
I want to go back a little bit from historical perspective, and was that actually any transition from the one agency to the other agency, or was that strictly an accounting manipulation that was taking place?
Co-chair Winters, we were operating when the Office of Emergency Management transitioned to the military department in 2008 under the same philosophy and structure that they had when they were at state police. So we were utilizing a direct cost allocation methodology where all of the positions were directly charged to the grant. We'd had multiple monitoring visits from FEMA where we shared with them how we were allocating costs, and at no point did they say anything different on in terms of transitioning to indirect. This was a new result in 2013 of the DHS OIGR.
Co-chair Winters, members of the committee, there's no agency inside OMD that gets audited more often than OEM. And so FEMA comes down every year since OEM has been underneath OMD since 2007 while I was in OMD, anywhere from 6 to 12 different audit monitoring visits a year. That's not counting the state stuff that occurred. And they thought we were doing fine. And then DHS OIG came in and said, yeah, that's not how we're going to do things here. And so they had 58 audits. Out of the 58, 21 of them had a question cost components. This is not, Oregon wasn't alone in this DHS OIG net of audits across this nation. We were just one of 21 that said, okay, you guys got to change your way of doing business. And so we're not happy to be here in front of this committee today to voice these. This has been an issue that we've been dealing with, and quite frankly, we didn't agree with them since 2013, but we're out of steps.
Oxygen.
Here. We are. Yes, Co-Chair's Winner.
Thank you. The revised financing model that we have is going to result in some funding structure changes in future biennia. We do anticipate submitting a fairly robust policy package or policy packages as part of our 1921 agency request budget to fund shift a number of positions inside of the Office of Emergency Management to reflect that more indirect nature of what they do, to include Mr. Phelps, who I'd like to hand things off to now.
Thank you, Sean. I'd like to provide a briefing with where we are with the second round of the DHS OIG audit. Last week, we conducted the entrance conference with the DHS audit team, including contractors from Williams Adley. That's the contracting firm, the auditing firm contracted by DHS to conduct this external audit. The audit will review the use of the State Homeland Security Grant Program and the Urban Area Security Initiative Grant Program in accordance with the law, program guidance, and state Homeland Security plans and other applicable laws. They'll also review the extent to which funds awarded enhance the ability of grantees to prevent, prepare for, protect against, and respond to natural disasters, acts of terrorism, and other man-made disasters. And finally, they'll look at whether or not any duplicate benefits were received by other federal agencies for the same or similar purposes as these two Homeland Security grant programs. We anticipate this audit will take several months to complete. My staff has been working diligently to provide them with documentation in advance of that entrance conference, and through the month of February and March, we'll continue to meet with the auditors and respond to requests for information so that they can conduct the most thorough audit possible. I'd like to also speak briefly, if I could, to the recent Secretary of State's audit. This is another layer of accountability for the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. Some of you may have seen or heard of the audit. There were 5 recommendations issued in that audit, of which OEM and the military department agreed with all 5 of those recommendations. And those recommendations were to continue to advocate for resources, finalize a plan to implement and track corrective actions for the recommendations from the Cascadia Rising exercise in 2016, to define the roles and responsibilities and expectations for emergency support function, state recovery function, and Oregon Emergency Response System agencies, to develop policies, procedures, and a schedule for implementing, maintaining, and exercising the 4 volumes of the state's comprehensive emergency management plan, and to complete the ongoing revisions to the office's strategic plan. We also will work with the governor's office for one of the governor's office's recommendation, that is to pursue the standards of the Emergency Management Accreditation Program, which are highlighted in the report as sort of the pinnacle of really what an emergency management program should look like. We do anticipate future reports as we track our progress on the Secretary of State audit as well as the DHS OIG audit, and we stand ready to provide additional updates on these audits or any other topics for which this committee has an interest at your convenience. With that, I'll hand it over to Deputy Director Stuckey.
Well, co-chairs, members of the committee, just want to close with, you know, we were dealing with this for several years. We're not excited to be here today to present this news to you, but we have to come up with a new way to restructure how OEM is funding certain positions within their agency. We fully expect that there will be some oversight response actions. We want to be able to come in and brief you as necessary and what these types of decisions could be, and with that, I'd like to close with: we see an equitable offset with the $3 million, even though they've discussed this, they picked that number. We think that we can find a way to fix that, but the other component where we're paying for staff and about the 1.6, we just simply don't have a means to finance that inside the agency. And so, with that, we would be happy to answer any additional questions.
So I have a question, and if you already stated this while I stepped out for a minute, I apologize. If we get everything in order, so everybody's happy that we have everything lined up, the money that we have switched from, you know, over to our funds or general fund, is there an opportunity to reclaim some of that back from the feds?
Coacher Stark, Coacher Winters, the answer to the question is there's the possibility that we'd be able to recoup a percentage of those costs. It would not be necessarily that we'd get all of them back, but based on what rate we're able to develop, and I believe our plan initially was a 10.9% indirect cost rate, so we could potentially get up to 10%, 11% of our costs back, potentially.
How much does the percentage actually come out to be? Is that?
Coacher Stark, Coacher Winters, the percentage is what we were able to calculate when we took into account all of our costs, and it came out to be approximately 11%. That's going to be the negotiated rate.
The number.
The number, I'd have to get back to you on that one.
Would you?
Yes, ma'am.
You know, sometimes we deal in hard numbers and not percentages.
We'd be happy to.
Are there any additional questions? Comments? Mr. Burke, what's our next step?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, committee members. As the agency mentioned, they have submitted a request for general fund to cover the administrative costs that are disallowed from their grants. So that will become part of the omnibus budget bill, which we'll see later in the session. This also represents an ongoing general fund cost for the state, having to change to the indirect cost allocation plan. So as Mr. McCormick mentioned, they will have to request a policy package for the next biennium in order to continue staffing themselves as
I think you need to repeat that, because I think it's important, because it will require a policy package coming back, and it will require, you know, going forward in the future. It's not just simply talking about a one-time action. I need to put that on the record, because often we talk so fast that those who are listening to us don't really get the gist of what we're doing going forward. So I needed to put that on the record of what this means, you know, beyond just today. But the co-chairs are working on it. So for me, I'm a lot about putting stuff on the record, as you know. Are there any additional questions or comments?
My sincere apologies for stepping out for a phone call I really didn't want to take. Shouldn't have taken it. So I just asked some quick questions and read through this really quickly. So it's 11% indirect rate on the federal grants, correct? Did they allow any federal indirect at all?
process.
Coach Winters, Coach Stark, Representative Sanchez, that's part of the process for a federal grant is that
yes,
you,
I know.
Yes, you do, and they do allow indirect costs on these federal grants.
But to not to that, what, I guess I'm confused.
We are able to, the indirect costs that were, my apologies.
What was, Coach, what was federal, what was the federal indirect that was allowable?
The rate.
Yes.
Was 10, what we have is submitted is a 10.9%. That's still to be negotiated. We haven't finalized our rate yet.
Oh.
And the rate's 18 to 24.
Okay. And the time frame for getting that developed is between 18 and 24 months is what we've been, was what we were building our assumption on.
We have to wait for the federal government to come back
to
us.
Yeah, I know.
It's a long
process.
Yeah,
no, an allocated federal, yes I do understand those. I do understand those. Okay, so, but you didn't have one before?
Coach Starks, Coach Winters, Representative Sanchez, that is correct because we were operating under the assumption that all the costs were direct and not indirect.
Okay, I get it now. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. You get your questions answered?
Thank you.
This is another agency sitting down there who actually does deal with grants.
Yes.
And indirect costs and all that.
I do understand those, yes. Thank you.
Any additional questions while we have these very able-bodied individuals from the Office of Management, Budget, and Military before us? Without that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And any further business, Mr. Berger?
Not today.
Co-Chair Stark?
Good.
We're good. We are adjourned.